We are back here on Wooden Sticks. I am Kevin Gorg. You found the Talk North Podcast Network. Really excited today to have another great hockey conversation with a legend here in Minnesota. Bob Mason will be our guest today. Bob grew up in International Falls, played for the Broncos back in the day. We're going back to the 70s here, and eventually would work his way into Duluth to play for the UMD Bulldogs in the early 80s. Would go on to a stellar National Hockey League career. Was a goaltender with Washington, Chicago, the Quebec Nordiques, and the Vancouver Canucks. And then I would get to know Bobby later in life. He had been the goaltending coach for 18 years for the Minnesota Wild. Started back in 2002, got hired by the great Jacques Lemaire in that time frame, and would last multiple coaching changes up through 2020 when he retired. Scratch golfer, terrific guy. Always enjoyed my conversations with Bob Mason. He's he doesn't get right to it. He's a very he's methodical the way he brings out interesting points. But when you work as a sideline reporter like I have now for 18 years covering the team, is you like to plug into that goalie coach and get some perspective from behind the scenes and what they're working on. And you know, he worked with some great goalies from Nicklas Backstrom through Devan Dubnyk, going back to Manny Fernandez and Dwayne Roloson, those two guys rotating in that magical run to the conference finals in 03. And Bobby's just a very, very interesting guy. And so looking forward to hearing about working for Jacques Lemaire, working in this organization for nearly two decades and surviving the coaching changes. He and Darby Hendrickson were the coaches that no matter who the bench boss was, they wanted them on their staff. So that's a real credit to what kind of coaches both Bob and Darby are. And then I really can't wait to talk about the epic game. It was about this time of year, and back in 1987, it's been tabbed the Easter Epic. And for you kids out there that maybe don't have that history at your disposal, you can Google this. It's incredible. It was a Game 7 winner-take-all in the Stanley Cup playoffs. And going back to the mid-80s, hockey had just kind of made the move to live, nationally televised playoff games. We didn't have the type of setup we have now. A lot of times in the early 80s, I was watching playoff games on tape delay. Unless it was the local team, back then it was the North Stars, you didn't get a lot of out-of-town games live. You got them tape delay at weird hours, 10 o'clock at night, midnight, 2 o'clock in the morning, didn't matter. So this particular game was center stage. There were no other playoff games going on in 1987, Easter weekend. Doc Emmerich and Bill Clement were on the call. So you had the A-team. And then you have the longest Game 7 in the history of the National Hockey League. And Bob Mason was in goal for the Washington Capitals. Kelly Rudy in goal for the New York Islanders. A fantastic, fantastic hockey game that would go quadruple overtime. It started on Saturday. It ended Easter Sunday morning at the wee hours out east at the Cap Center in Landover, Maryland. Just, the game, thinking back on that, it was just such an awesome game to watch. 75-57 were the shots on goal. Caps outshot them. Kelly Rudy and Bob Mason dueling to the wire. And finally, Pat LaFontaine. Another name, of course, that's tied to Minnesota hockey. And for all of us that are even still, we should probably let it go, but even still to this day frustrated that our good friend and former guest on our show, Lou Nanny, selected as the first overall pick in the draft. And you got to think about, again, where the North Stars were at that time. They had had some pretty good playoff success. And Pat LaFontaine was widely considered to be one of the two or three guys at the top of the draft. The North Stars would end up taking Brian Lawton. And at the time, that pick made sense because if you looked at a lot of the publications nationally, and I read the hockey news back in the day, it was a coin flip between LaFontaine and the guy we took. And the guy we took ended up being an okay player, Brian Lawton. I've seen him around at Wild games to this day, and he's working for the NHL Network. Super nice guy. But LaFontaine ended up being an unbelievable player. A guy named Steve Eiserman a little later in the draft, I believe, that year. So North Star fans still hold that as a name that brings back some old wounds. So Pat LaFontaine held the puck in at the blue line. There was traffic in front of Bob Mason and rifled that puck that just seemed to have eyes as it navigated its way through the mass of humanity in the slot. And it looked to me, and we'll get to the definitive answer today on the show, Bob Mason maybe never saw that puck. but it legitimately is one of the greatest games in the history of the league. And like I mentioned, longest game seven ever. And of course, the guys on the call made the broadcast that much more enjoyable for all of us that were able to watch that game. Bob Mason was a player of the year in the WCHA. I didn't know that until I started digging in and doing some research. After the 82-83 season, he was voted as the most valuable player in that league. And this is back in the league when they were players up and down each roster that were superstars that would go on to play in the National Hockey League. So Bob was one hell of a goalie. And always great stories with Bob Mason. And I really am excited to hear someone went into some of those big decisions. And I look back at his time as a goaltending coach with the Minnesota Wild, and that particular season in 03, when they upset both Colorado and Vancouver, if you recall, it was two different goalies. And I don't think the opposition knew which way the Wild were going to go. It was Manny Fernandez one night. It was Dwayne Rolison the next. It was Manny Fernandez for two or three games. Then it was Rolison for two or three games. And they made a huge difference in both those series. I look back at game seven in Colorado. Manny Fernandez stood on his head. He was remarkable in that hockey game. Tremendous performance. And then Dwayne Rolison kind of took over in the next series when Vancouver was a huge favorite. That one would also go seven. In both series, Minnesota would come back from 3-1 deficits. Bob Mason was right there. He was living it with Jacques Lemaire, Mario Tremblay, Mike Ramsey. So some great stuff today on Wooden Sticks. We'll put him on the hat trick hot seat. And we'll have some just awesome hockey conversations that start in International Falls, work their way to Duluth, and then departs all over the National Hockey League, including the Easter Epic. As we get ready to celebrate Easter again this year, we'll look back on one of the all-time great games in the National Hockey League, and Bob Mason was in the crease for that unbelievable hockey game. Hey, if you want to be a part of the show, we'd love to have you. We're still looking for a title sponsor and anybody else that wants to be a part of the show. All you've got to do is send a quick note to Karen Cleary at K-C-L-E-A-R-Y. K-Cleary at TalkNorth.com. Be a part of the show. When we come back, Bob Mason, our next guest, right here on Wooden Sticks. We are back on the Talk North Network. This is Wooden Sticks. I'm your host, Kevin Gorg. Very excited for our guest today. He is from International Falls, longtime college NHL goaltender and longtime goaltending coach with the Minnesota Wild for 18 years from 2002 through 2020. My good friend, Bobby Mason. Bob, welcome to the show.
Great having me. I mean, let me tell you, we used to see each other every day, and now I see it maybe once a summer.
It's tough. Yeah, I don't get on the golf course like I used to. You're not around the rink as much as you obviously were. 18 years, you know, I look at you and Darby Hendrickson, Bob, as kind of unicorns in the NHL business. And I've been on the beat since 2006 covering this team, but you don't see specialty coaches that stick around and last through multiple coaching changes. Yet I look at your tenure with the Minnesota Wild, which started all the way back when Jacques Lemaire was the head coach. And I look at what Darby Hendrickson is still doing. I believe you made it through three or four. He's made it through five or six different coaches. Why do you think that's possible? Because it just does not happen in this league.
Yeah, that's a good question. Darby was, I was talking to him about that the other, I think we both had six. Darby's on six right now. So I said, just be careful.
My goodness.
You know, we're just, you know, you get along with the, just your niche of what I do. I mean, I work with the D, work with the forwards, work with the goalies most of the time, doing, you know, D drills with the goalies or shooting drills. So you just had a rapport with everybody, and it was kind of a easygoing rapport. I mean, it wasn't like a hardcore, you know, head coach has got to get down on these guys, you know, PK coach, PP coach, you know, they got to get a little venom going once in a while. I kind of stayed away from that. And, you know, that's how I was, you know, when I was coached, you know, my top guy was Warren Strelo from Montemita. I mean, Warren was always a positive guy. And, you know, he was always a go-between guy. You know, he did the same thing, you know, working with the forwards, working with the D, working with the goalies. So you kind of get in that lane, and it's, you know, if you have success, you know, you're going to stick around for a while, and, you know, you have good goaltenders, you know, good scouts, or you pick the right people. And I had a lot of good goaltenders through those years. And that made it a lot easier.
What was it like working for a legendary coach like Jacques Lemaire?
Well, Jacques was, I mean, I was watching him in high school, you know, when he was the big cup winning Canadians, you know, we would get up in International Falls, we'd get Hockey Night in Canada. And we, you know, That was our channel. We couldn't get the North Star games, but we get Montreal Toronto games every Saturday night. So I got the job. My dad called me because, God, you're going to be working with Jacques Lemaire, you know, because he was one of the guys with the big bad Canadians back in those days. So he was, you know, Jacques let you do. I mean, I remember coming in for a meeting with him, and I walked into 317 Washington. I'd done my contract with Riseborough. This was like in June. And Doug said, I want to hire you. You're going to have to talk to Jock when he comes to town in August. So I had to wait all summer. So I did the Devo camp up in, we did the Devo camp up in Brainerd. You know, it was a 3-week camp up there. So I was up there for 3 weeks with Mario. So I got to know Mario Tremblay. And then Rammer was coaching. And then Jock comes to town. I go down to 317, meet him. I remember walking into the office there, and I was just going to pull the door open, and Tobin Wright was kind of video coach, kind of team coordinator. Tobin opens it, and Jock's right there. And Tobin, I remember Tobin said, "Dave, coach, this is Bob Mason." I remember Jock going, "I didn't pitch you looking like this." So I think he visually had me looking like a different guy. So anyway, he just said, let's go down to my office at Excel Center, and let's watch some tape. So the two tapes were Manny and Rolly. So we just kind of went over Manny a little bit, went over Rolly a little bit, and not long. It was just some questions, and I just did some commentating on just what they were doing. And Jock said, "You know what you're talking about." And then bang, that was it. And I signed a deal there. I think a 3-year deal right away.
So, but he was a little bit later. Yeah.
Yeah. He was, you know, he working with, yeah, he was, you know, he was kind of, you get kind of had to get into a circle a little bit. He was a tight, sure. Tight circle, you know, so Mario was always tight with him. And then Rammer got in tight, and then took me a little bit, but you know, it was just, he was, thank God Manny and Rolly were playing pretty dang good. And you know, that kept him out of my hair a little bit, I guess. So I didn't really ever catch the wrath of Jock. I mean, once in a while he'd get on you, but as long as the goalies were playing good, you were in good form.
Well, and in 2003, they were playing fantastic. So whatever you were working on was working. And it was so unique at that time, because I look back at that era of the NHL, which is different than where we are now, Bob. But, you know, rotating goalies specifically in the playoffs was almost unheard of. And you guys not only did it, but you did it with some huge success, big upset victories against Colorado and Vancouver. How did those discussions go as you guys mapped out a plan for the playoffs and then executed that plan with both Manny Fernandez and Dwayne Rolison playing, you know, such an equal role?
Yeah, they were equal. I think, you know, Rolly started the Colorado series, and at the end of the series, it was kind of Manny that took over, and then it was almost the opposite with Vancouver. Manny kind of started, then Rolly kind of took that series over. Yeah, we talked a lot. Coaching staff, we'd go out for dinner every night, and we'd bring up the goalies. "Who are we going to start?" Jock would say, "Who are we going to start, Mace?" I said, "Well," I said, "let's see. Rolly played pretty good. He won." But that first, yeah, I'm not sure exactly why we started with Rolly. It was tough because we're down 3-1. And then I think Rolly played part of game 5, and he got, oh, we think we took him out. Then Manny went in 5, 6, and 7. And Manny was, you know, hadn't played in 2 weeks. I just remember he was really, really nervous. You know, he was always a little nervous anyway, but he was like, "No, God, now it's on my plate, Mace." I said, "Well, it just happens. It's going to be on your plate." I said, "You get nothing to lose, everything to gain." I said, "Just, you're good. You're going to be nervous. Once you make that first save, you're going to slide right into it." And boy, 5, 6, and 7, he was fantastic. And those are clutch games, 5, 6, and 7. My God, he was.
Well, game 7, Bob. I mean, that's one of the greatest performances by a Wild goaltender in the history of the franchise. It might be the greatest performance. If you go back and look and watch game 7, he was remarkable in that game in Denver.
Yeah, he was. You know, he was, yeah, it was like 30, what was it, 4-3 we won, I think.
Yep.
30.
Or was it 3-2?
I think it might have been 4-3. I think they went up 3-2. I remember Darby took the penalty late in the third, kind of 7, 8, 10 minutes ago, And we got a power play and scored, tied it. I think it was 3-3. And then Bruno scores in overtime. But, yeah, Manny was – I think he was 34 out of 37 that night. I remember the glove save on Rob Blake. You know, he kind of made the rush up the ice. And he got it, you know, 10 feet inside the blue line, full speed, and he just zipped one. And Manny did the old Ken Dryden, just a gorgeous glove save. You know,
that was such a fun hockey game. Yeah, I mean, for all of us that had our hearts ripped out when the North Stars left, I look at that night is the night we finally put the ghosts of hockey past to bed. Like, it was a really big moment for a lot of us of a certain age, because the Wild became our team that night. That was a turning point, and it was early on, right? I mean, the team was new, and you just took down one of the best teams.
Third year.
Amazing that you won that series. What was it like in the aftermath? Like, what was the celebration like on the way to the next series? Because, I mean, you guys basically shocked the hockey world that night.
Yeah, we did. I mean, I think Vancouver was, they might have had a game 7 too with St. Louis that year. They came back and beat St. Louis. I can't remember if we flew right up to Van or if we came home and then went to Van. I can't remember what we did there. It was a long time ago, but
the games were more sandwiched together back then. You had some back-to-back games within those series.
Yeah, we had 6 and 7 with Vancouver back-to-back, 6 here and crazy. 7 in Vancouver. Right up, yeah, we were, you know, we were on that bus, and the bus T-boned that limo going to the rink.
I remember that story. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it wasn't easy.
No, it wasn't easy, yeah, it was. I mean, some of those are quick turnarounds. And then even that series was a huge quick turnaround after game 7 in Vancouver. We stayed overnight in Vancouver, flew back to Minnie, and then we played the next afternoon at 2:00 against the Ducks. And we lost a double
overtime
game. On
national TV, I remember that. Yeah, so it was crazy.
They dictated the time, and, you know, it would have been nice to have another day off, you know, because we just played two game seven series back to back. Yeah, I mean, who knows? If we win that first game, you know, maybe we get the finals. We had home ice against them, and, you know, Gabrick had we had glorious chances, and Jaguar was, you know, obviously he was the Conn Smythe winner that year. They lost to the Devils in 7 in the finals, but he was a Conn Smythe winner, and he won that series against, you know, we didn't play that bad. We just couldn't score.
No.
You know, it was
two rip, one rip, two one,
I think it was, something like that. So they're close.
That was the big equipment. That was, I think, part of the information they used to get the goaltending equipment tightened up a little bit, because he was almost too good. It was ridiculous how hard it was to beat him. And I look at your tenure as Wild goalie coach, and I think a lot of people know you as that guy, but I think most people that are of a certain age like me remember you playing for the UMD Bulldogs, playing in the National Hockey League. How did it all start, Bobby? How did you not only come to hockey, but how did you want to become a goalie? How did that conversation go when you were a kid?
Well, I didn't start as a goalie. You know, I had a twin brother, Billy. So we had we had a nice long basement with a tiled floor that, you know, we go down and, you know, it was probably a 50-foot long basement floor, and we could shoot tennis balls. I was always a goalie, you know. And Billy was a shooter, and we'd go down there between periods, hockey night camp, every Saturday. Period over, we'd go down there, and he'd shoot tennis balls on me for, you know, 20 minutes. And but when we were playing rec hockey, I was a forward, just didn't need a goalie. And then I distinctly remember it. It was just one night he was sick. I jumped in the net, and I think we won the game. Didn't have a great team, but played pretty good. And I was probably 5th grade, maybe. And then I just stuck in there, and just, you know, we had, God. Then growing up, I'm watching, I don't remember the name, Peter Wasilowicz.
Yes, I do.
All-state guy, 71, 72, 73. I think he was an all-stater. It was him and Pete Lapresti. Pete was at Eveleth. So I was always watching those two guys. And, you know, Wasilowicz went to North Dakota, and Lapresti went to Denver. But I remember, you know, Peter was the God. You watched him. And then the next wave came in about 2 years. Kevin Constantine came in.
Yep.
And Kevin was, you know, fantastic. You know, that was our video back then, Gorgie. We didn't have video. My video was my video was just watching these guys and trying to play like them. That's how I try to pick up styles and everything. So, So, I mean, that anyway, that's how I stuck in there and rec hockey. And then, bang, I'm doing Bantams. I'm doing, you know, Pee-wee's Bantams in high school. And I always had to play another year Bantam Bees because the other two guys I had in front of me was David Lorien, played at Notre Dame.
Yes.
David was, you know, Kevin played 2.5 years as a starter. And then David came in 1 year as a starter. And then it was my turn the next year, 79. David was 78. Kevin was 76, 77. So I, you know, played pretty good. I think we lost to Rapids in Section 7 finals. It was John Casey. And I just didn't have enough games under my belt. So almost went to junior college. And then I took a route. I had a buddy going to Green Bay, Wisconsin to play for the Green Bay Bobcats. And he got me a phone number for a guy. And I just say, I think Green Bay had kind of International Falls area. So it wasn't even a draft. It was just kind of areas. So I went there and, you know, made that team, played, you know, like close to 100 games in 2 years there. And I got pretty good. And, you know, that's when you got all of a sudden you got a bunch of college scouts looking at you. Then you got some pro scouts looking at you. I'm coming from nowhere.
And those are key years, Bobby.
Yeah. I'm not like I'm barely playing high school. And a year and a half later, I got all these people coming to watch me in Green Bay. And I'm like, so that's how quick it turned. And that really motivated me. It was like, holy God, these guys are coming to town. Gump Worsley was coming to town. Bernie Perrant with Philly was coming to town to watch me play juniors. Wasn't drafted that year, which turned out to be a blessing, but I was a little disappointed, but I wasn't. And
that's when that Gus led Anderson, you to UMD, though. That time in Green Bay gave you the chance to become a part of the UMD hockey program. And I didn't know this, Bobby. All these years, and you know, I watched you play forever, and especially in the National Hockey League, I didn't realize you were the WCHA Player of the Year for UMD after the 82-83 season. Now, that is a hell of an accomplishment in that league at that time with all those great players. Talk about that experience for you as a UMD goalie that had that type of success.
Well, just it was highly motivated weekend hockey. I mean, you just, like Rammer always said, in college hockey, you let the animals out of the cage on Friday. And you're ready. You're just like, nobody's tired, right? You know, Rammer always talked juniors to college. You know, the juniors are playing all week, and we were just weekend guys, and we were like, boy, you couldn't wait to go. And, you know, I think that sophomore year I played 46 out of the 48 games. And, you know, we have number one team in the country for about 3 weeks at that one time. You know, Curvers, Tommy was there, and, you know, we had Greg Moore from Edina that was playing really well. We had, Watson and Adnakon came into town. Norm McIver was there. So we had some pretty good players. But, I mean, the Gophers were solid. Wisconsin was good. North Dakota was good. We finished fourth. I think we were fourth in the league that year. But we beat North Dakota, like, I think we played each other at that time. We played them 6 times. We beat them 5, I think. But, you know, you're player of the week. You're all of a sudden you're player of the week again. Then a couple of weeks go by, then you're player of the week again. So I was kind of racking those things up. I was, you know, we were winning and, you know, I was stopping a lot of pucks. And it was funny because I remember we lost at Providence in the NCAA quarterfinals out at Providence. Lou Lamoriello was coaching Providence. It was a 2-game total goal series back then. So anyway, Surdy grabs me after the game. He said, hey, USA Hockey wants you to fly to Tokyo. You got to go up to Boston, go over to the World Championships. So the goalies for the U.S. team that year were Jimmy Craig came back. Jimmy was trying to get back in the league, and then Paul Lotsby was a backup. So I flew over, and I was sitting in the lunchroom, and John Harrington was on that team. And he came over to me. He said, hey, it was the USA Today clippings. Said Minnesota. Said sophomore goaltender Bob Mason wins WCHA MVP. That's how he found out. And Surdy won Coach of the Year that year. Surdy was my little headline, and then Mike Surdich. Mike Surdich named Coach of the Year WCHA.
Holy cow!
Found that out in Tokyo. Crazy.
You're in Tokyo. You get the update from Harrington, and Coach Surdich had to be just a trip to play for. I always enjoyed my conversations with him over the years, and just watching him behind the bench at UMD, the passion he had for hockey and just how much fun it looked like he was having.
Yeah, he was. First year was, he was assistant. It was Gus Hendrickson, and Gus was a, you know, legendary Iron Ranger from Rapids. And Gus, yeah, it was weird. He got let go of that spring of that, my freshman year. And Surdy was going to leave, just get out of hockey. Cause he was a recovery. He was, you know, hitting the beer too much. He was going to, you know, he did go to rehab, but he was going to get out of hockey, just get, do something else. And Ralph Romano was the AD at the time. And Ralph, I don't think he had a plan when he fired Gus. he went to Surdy, and Surdy said, I'll take it for 1 year, interim coach. Really was coach of the year, his first 3 years. You know, ended up spending, 17 years as a head there. He was – Surdy was a motivator, let me tell you. God, could he motivate that locker room, you know. Pretty good X and O guy. You know, he knew his hockey big time.
Sure
you
did.
Know, he had a good eye, but he was a very good – just his speeches would just motivate you. And you know, we were tight. I mean, we had a tight team and all those years up there. I mean, he was unlucky not to win. He could have won two NCAA tournaments, you know, back to back. They lost to Bowling Green in 84 and what, four overtimes. And, The next year, I think they lost to, who beat them in 85? That's when Holly was in there, Brett Hull's first year. I think they lost RPI in Detroit. Yeah. But Surdy, yeah, he was rock solid, and he was, he was, then he went to Tech, you know, everybody leaves, you know, and he, you know, it wasn't a happy ending for him, I think, at Duluth. You know, it should have been a, you know, a celebration of his coaching career, and it was kind of the opposite when he got out of there. It was kind of a sad deal that happened, but, you know, I think he's mended everything there. I've seen him at games there, and so, and Sandy Sandlin loves him too. So Sandy's really kind of brought him back into the fold a little bit.
Wonderful guy. And at what point when you were growing up, did pro hockey hit your radar? You end up playing for Washington, Chicago, Quebec, and Vancouver. But, you know, when you're growing up in the National Falls, I'm certain that the next biggest thing is you just want to play in Bronco Arena and play, you know, high school hockey. And then you're, like you said, you went to Green Bay hoping that something would work out there. You didn't get drafted. When did pro hockey really become something that was a realistic goal for you, Bob?
Well, it was that second year in Green Bay was, you know, when all these scouts were coming in there. And then I was, you know, then I, like I said, the next step was Duluth. A lot of scouts coming to those games. Like I said, it turned out to be a blessing being a free agent. And then I make the Olympic team. So I played 2 years at Duluth, Olympic tryouts, 83, summer of 83, Colorado Springs at the Broadmoor. Go in there and, you know, knock out, you know, we had two Givens. Tommy Brasso was a given spot, and Mark Barron, the All-American from Wisconsin. They had the two, they were guaranteed two spots. So it was like, you know, six goalies for a spot, maybe if they keep three.
Wow.
Well, I go out there. Brad Buteau was our coach in the West team. We win the tournament. My partner was Cleon Daskalakis, All-American at BU. Cleon hurts his knee game one. So I play 3.5 games, go 3-0. And championship game, I think I kicked 40 out of 40, 4-0 win.
Oh, you know, wow.
Buteau's just loving it. He's hugging me. And, you know, I'm saying, easy, Brett. So Lou Vero was the head coach, and Luke comes into the room. He said, we got our goalies picked, but if I don't pick you, I'm going to look like the dumbest guy on the planet. So you're going to be picked. I'm going to pick you tomorrow. You're going to be one of our three. So I said, great. So that's, you know, then we had the three-headed monster with myself, Brasso, and Barron. And then Tommy, you know, we had played the Soviet Wings up in Anchorage and Fairbanks in September. Tommy played a couple games in Fairbanks. Remember, he flies back to Massachusetts for his sister's wedding, and the Sabres sign him. So he's gone.
So that's right.
You know, yeah, So we were, you know, just two on the team. And then I knew, you know, I was locked in. Yeah. I mean, so the big question was, am I going to go back? If I don't get picked, am I going to go back to UMD or am I going to sign pro? Because I had just hired Brian Burke, was my agent. I just hired Berkey. Berkey's like, Mace, I got four offers right now to sign you.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, thank God that road didn't happen, because I didn't know what I was going to do, if I would have went back to school or not. Probably would have signed, because, you know, I was a free agent, and then, you know, I had the height of my earning, you know, my power there for a contract. So anyways, for played sure. whole year out, and yeah, the Devils, Caps, going to Washington, Strela was probably a major factor in that. And pretty good team, you know, they had Scott Stevens, really Rod Lang. Yes, Rod Langway, Scott Stevens, you know, Kevin Hatcher, Larry Murphy, you know, pretty good deep core back there. So that was kind of an easy choice. Took out a little bit of money, though. It took a little less going to Washington than going to New Jersey. But the Devils
You had the security of Strelo and that blue line that you knew would be a probably an easier transition.
Exactly.
And that you played in four cities. I mentioned them. Washington, yeah. Chicago, Quebec, and Vancouver. Take the hockey out of it. And I've been to three of these frequently. I have not ever been to Quebec. What was your favorite place to live?
Probably downtown Chicago.
Oh, yeah.
Funny, when I got there, it was kind of 87 Canada Cup. So I was a third goalie on that team. It was Team USA 87 Canada Cup. It was Van Biesbroek, Tommy Brasso, and myself were the three goalies. So I was third man, just signed a big deal with the Blackhawks that summer, free agent. Kind of got out of shape because nobody was skating. And I get to camp. I just remember I get to camp and I was didn't know where to live. Eddie Olchuk just gets traded to Toronto. So Eddie goes, I got a place out in Naperville. Why don't you move into my house? So I did that. I did that for like 3 weeks. And it was like, you know, the traffic there was like, it took me an hour and a half to get to Chicago Stadium. So I ended up moving downtown in a high rise, a couple floors under Kurt Frazier. Remember Fraz?
Oh, yeah.
Bill Norris. Yeah. So me and Fraz live in the same building. So that was the funnest. It was kind of cool down there. My wife, I wasn't married at the time, but Victoria was a flight attendant with Northwest. So she was down there a lot, and yeah, it was a good times. Best team,
in Chicago
though,
Stadium.
Yeah, I mean, just the city and the stadium, place to live. I like that the best. Probably like playing the best in Washington. You know, Vancouver was solid, but I was just kind of back and forth. I was with the Milwaukee Admirals, so I was kind of up and down, up and down. And then Quebec was, you know, Quebec was kind of fun too. You know, we had a pretty good team, but we just didn't. Have any points. I mean, Goulet was there, Joe Sakic's first year. We had the Stasny brothers, Anton and Peter Stasny. And Mario Gosselin was my partner.
The Goose.
Yeah, he was free and easy, that guy was. But that was fun. Yeah. A lot of snow up there, Gorgie. Holy, I thought International Falls had snow. It snowed in Quebec City, I mean, 4 to midnight every day.
Really?
Oh, my God. It was scary how much snow they had up there.
I need to get there, and I think the old building, the Coliseum, is still there. I'd love to see it sometime. I've heard nothing but great stories just about, you know, because back then when we got to watch playoff games, if you caught a Montreal-Quebec playoff game, there was nothing like it.
Yeah. Quebec-Hartford, Quebec-Boston, that Adams division was, yeah. Those teams were all loaded. Pretty good back then. Yeah, they were loaded.
They were all – you mentioned some of the names. I mean, the Nordiques had – some fantastic players. And, you know, back then Boston had some great teams. Hartford was still competitive.
Neely, Bork, you know, yes. Yeah, Reggie Lemelin.
Was it Andy the Adams Moe. Division?
Adams division, yeah. Then he had Mike Lee. Yeah, then he had, you know, Ray Ferraro, Dean Evason, Ray Ferraro. Those guys were all on Hartford. I knew all those guys because when my first year in Washington, our farm team was in Binghamton, and we were 10 guys from Washington, 10 guys from Hartford. So of all those course. Guys were down there. Yeah, all those guys were down there. That's the first time I met. Well, Dean was a Washington Capitol draft pick. And then he was traded for, who was he traded for? I think David A. Jensen, the Olympic player, out east guy.
Because Dean spent most of his career in Hartford.
He did. Early on. With Tex Evans, Larry Plo, yeah. Yeah.
Well, the timing of our conversation is spectacular because, you know, the Easter Epic is still one of the all-time legendary NHL games. And for the youngsters that are listening, we're going back to Easter weekend, 1987. And, you know, back then, hockey on national TV was a new thing. But this game in particular was a Game 7. The Islanders and Pat LaFontaine, as you mentioned, against Bob Mason and the Washington Capitals, winner take all. Mike Emmerich and Bill Clement were on the call, combined 132 shots on goal, and it's still the longest game seven in the history of the National Hockey League. At the time of this game, Bobby, it ended up being the longest game since 1951. Now, there have been longer playoff games since, but this was quadruple overtime. And I got to ask you, just competing in a game like that, when, let's face it, nutrition back in the mid-80s isn't what it is now. Like, we know a lot more now how to keep these players hydrated, how to keep them fed. This is a game that went from a Saturday night, the weekend of Easter, into Easter morning. And I can't imagine for you, who never gets a break, the goalie, you're out there the entire time, how you manage to stay hydrated and stay upright and stay strong mentally and physically in a game like that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we were like drinking salt water, I think. I think we ran out of Gatorade. We had a nutritionist in there. Oh, everybody drink salt water. You know, so we were like,
that
yeah.
That was a thing back then. I remember that.
Yeah, we drink. Yeah, it tasted terrible. It would really
hydrate you.
Yeah. So back then, God, we were drinking Coke between periods. I mean, always.
For sure. There were guys smoking in the locker room.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, that was, I think I lost 15 pounds when I weighed myself like the next day. Negative 15 pounds. So I was a bone rack. I was down to nothing. Oh, yeah. You're just on adrenaline, though. You know, I didn't cramp up. You know, I think I cramped up when I think getting out of the shower. I think putting on my shoes after the game, my bottom of my feet started cramping up. But I never cramped up during the whole game. It was crazy. You know, but I was, probably 27-ish at that time. So I was, yeah, cramping never hit me till I was like 30. But yeah, that game was, I was talking to David Poile. Well, it was maybe a year ago at one of those USA Hockey banquets. And he said, he came over, he brought that game up right away. He said that game will never be broken because there's never going to be there was one penalty called in four overtime periods from Andy Van Helman. And it was a four. Wow. So it just went 4-4. So nobody had a power play. And it was like I said the same thing. David said, Mace, it was like a football game out there. Guys were getting tackled. And, you know, back then it was, you know, a lot of stick fouls
they let more go on for sure.
Oh, and totally.
You know, you think of quadruple overtime, that's seven periods of hockey. You're two games plus another period on your body. And then I think of the mental side of things, Bobby, just the stress. This isn't, you know, just some throwaway game in a series that's been decided. This is game seven. This is, you know, win or go home. And with that type of pressure, I just don't know how you stay into that moment. And sure, adrenaline probably keeps you going as far as the physical part of things, but the stress mentally, what were the conversations like in the intermissions? Like, do the coaches run out of things to say?
Yeah, they weren't even coming in. You know, it was just, you know, we were resting and trying to hydrate you know, Brian Murray was a coach. Brian would come in and, you know, just say 5 minutes to go, he'd say a couple of words, but it was, you know, we had a 3-1 lead in the series though, you know.
I know.
Pete Peters played 1 and 2 at home. We split, go to Long Island. I play 3 and 4, 2-0 win, 3-2 win. Come back to Cap Center for game 5. We're up 3-1. I think Brian thought we were going to wrap it up that night. Didn't play me, played Pete, lost 4-2. Then I played game 6 back at Nassau County. We end up losing 4-2 open net goal. And we got game 7 back at the Cap Center. And they said, Mace, you're going. So,
oh, man.
But it was, I mean, I don't know what happened. I mean, I did not bring that up to David Poile why I didn't play game five.
No,
I should have. Oh, that was about a year ago. I should have, you know, God rest Brian Murray's soul. Brian was a hell of a coach. Brian was, yeah, he was a fantastic coach. But they had Al Arbor, pretty smart coach too.
Pretty good coach, right? One of the all-time greats.
That was the first year Billy Smith was not playing. Kelly Rudy took over the reins for playoff. That was the first year Billy sat on the bench. So remember after game 7.
I watched every minute of it.
He came over. I remember I'm kind of sitting, you know, they're all celebrating and we're kind of just in daze and I'm just sitting on my one knee in the crease and Billy Smith would never ever, if you remember this, he never shook hands with the other team after the series. He just go off the ice. He goes, I'm not going to shake hands.
Which was weird.
Yeah. So so coming out, our net was by their exit area, and he skates over to me, and I look down, I see those blue Billy Coho pads. Billy Smith is where I'm going, shit, that's Billy Smith. And he grabbed my hand, he shook my hand, he goes, best goaltending game I've ever seen in my life. He said, keep it up.
Oh,
then,
man.
Then he skated off. Yeah.
So. Well, I was watching with Marco Seeky and some other buddies from Burnsville, and we were cheering for you guys, the Minnesota goalie thing. Plus, we were so bitter about the Islanders beating the North Stars in the Cup a handful of years earlier. We were all in on the Caps, and it looked to me on that winning goal, and I remember it vividly, where LaFontaine, he barely holds the puck in high in the slot. There's like five bodies in between him and you in the net. It looked to me like you never saw the puck, Bob, on that winning goal.
Yeah, it was just I think it was Gord Denine went around the net, and he from right to left and got over on the left side, and he threw it out. And I think Kevin Hatcher was out there. I think him and Langway were paired up, and it kind of ricocheted off. You know, he long sticked, kind of went right off his stick. I think Pat was going off the ice for a line change, and he took a look, and the puck's just floating out to me. So he kind of did the little 360 spin around, and he one-timed it, and yeah, went. I look at it now, I was deep in the net, but I didn't see anything. It just hit the post and game over. So, but the tying goal, Gorgie, was like 5 minutes to go in the third, and Trotsche came in, and he was on the right side on his backhand, and he let a backhander go from, you know, just below the faceoff dot. And I'm kind of, you know, we weren't butterfly sliding back then. We were just kind of shuffling across, and the rivet in my Lang goalie skate broke on my right leg, my right ankle, and my ankle buckled, and the puck went five hole. And Van Helman,
oh, it was, no way.
Yeah. So Andy comes over, and I said, is there something wrong with my skate, Andy? I said, the ankle's giving out. So Dougie Shear, the equipment guy, came out, and he said, yeah, that rivet just sheared right off. And so there's 5 minutes to go, and he goes, you know, I'd skate around a little bit. It was okay. Then I make a certain move. It would kind of buckle. I'm like, Brian's like, I'm not going to put Pete in. You're going to have to play. Just do it. Do the best. So I played the last 5 minutes. I played the last 5 minutes with a broken rivet on my Lang goalie skate. You know, I think I had a couple shots.
That had to be stressful all by itself.
Oh, my God. Totally. You know, I'm glad the Islanders didn't know what was going on, you know. They thought it was probably fixed, right?
Oh, for crying out loud. Of course they did. You're not going to send a goalie out there with a broken skate.
Any pressure around the net or any east-west game or east-west play and I got a push, there was no way I was going to get it.
Oh, for crying out loud.
Period ends, go into the locker room. He puts a screw and a nut together and threw it in there, and it was secure.
And it lasted for four more periods, thankfully. And
yeah.
Well, you have such a different perspective when you're a goalie. I think of the mid-80s and into the late-80s, some of the great players in the league. For you, Bob, who was the best player that you ever faced? And maybe it was in practice, maybe it was in a game, but the best NHL player you ever faced as a goalie?
Oh, probably 99 and 66.
Oh, that's pretty good picks right there, yeah.
You know, we played Pittsburgh all the time, and Mario was, you know, very dangerous, probably more dangerous than Wayne. And, I, you know, we were in the East, so we always played Pittsburgh, but I didn't play against Wayne a lot, just being, you know, in Edmonton. You'd get him once, you get him twice a year. So, you know, and then, yeah, got it. I mean, you had Dennis Savard in Chicago at the time. Danny was playing well. Who the Rangers have? But there was those two guys. It was always Mario was like, he was. Wasn't great yet, but he was, you know,
he was coming. Yeah. And back to Gretzky, like I looked at him and I watched him shoot the puck, and his shot didn't look like much, but he found a way to score a lot of times from distance. And I'll never understand how, and maybe you didn't see him enough or regularly enough to understand it, but that guy could, maybe it's just the placement of the puck, but he found a way to score goals a lot of times from distance, and I could never figure out why the goalies couldn't stop it.
Yeah, you know, through the 80s, there was a lot of rush plays at the net, you know, and he would you know, you'd get the rush. Yeah. Well, the classic goal is a shot on Vernon, you know, the playoffs that year.
Yes.
You know, coming down, and that's kind of, you know, he was a mid-distance guy. He wasn't long range. It was mid-distance. And he could pick, he could hit it. He could, he was accurate. I mean, that shot, I mean, God, if he misses that by a quarter inch, it's probably post and out, or Vernie stopping it. But it was just a perfect shot coming down, you know, like Mike. Well, the other guy was Mike Bossy. He's the other guy I would put, throw into that category. Bossy scored.
Yes.
You know, he was sniping 50 a year. You know, so he was probably the guy. It was him and Mario, and then maybe Wayne. But Bossy was, I remember the first time his shot hit me was in Cap Center. He got a shot in kind of the high slot, and that thing hit me, almost took my arm off. It was I mean, I made the save, but the thing just hit me, and I'm like, oh, my God. Then he'd come down that right side, he'd take that slapper. Same thing with Wayne, right? He'd shoot that, he'd shoot that mid-distance off the rush, slapper top of the circle, inside top of the circle. He'd get you short side, he'd get you far corner. Yeah, all the time. He did it to me. He did it to Pat Riggin. He did it to Al Jensen. He did it to Pete Peters. So I wasn't the only Cap guy he was victimizing.
And within the Capitals, like, let's say practice, you had Mike Gartner. And I'll never forget, Bill Clement was the analyst in your Game 7, the epic Easter battle with the Islanders. And I don't know if it was that series or a different Caps playoff series, but Bill Clement uttered these words: when Mike Gartner gets the puck alone in the slot, not even God can stop him. And he was paying tribute to what an adroit sniper Gartner was. So you've seen his shot. Why was he so good?
He was another righty like Bossy. He was the original jersey flapper going down the wing. You know, everybody's talking about Modano, but Gartner was before that. His jersey would flap because he'd be so fast going down that right side. And then he was same thing. He'd take that slapper coming off that right dot, top of the circle, and he'd snipe it. But he got the puck off. You know, Darby ended up playing with him too in Toronto, and he just get it off quick, especially around, you know, the slot, you know, that area. Don't get it and hold it. Just shoot it. And that's
quick shot beats the hard shot. That's always the mentality of those good goal scorers.
Yeah.
I thought there was a great line by Bill Clement, though. Not even God could stop him. I'll never forget that. You know, I love old school classic broadcasts. And I went back and watched some of your game from the Easter Epic. And, you know, with Doc Emmerich and Bill Clement on the call, it's just the drama just oozes. And Emmerich had a way of making whatever game he was calling feel bigger than it was. But this was a Game 7. And this was two teams that had gone back and forth. You mentioned it. You guys had that series kind of within your grasp, and the Islanders were coming back, and this is past their big run. And it just, that game had such a big feel. And I think back then, Bobby, you know, nationally televised live hockey games were kind of new, you know, in the early 80s, we had to watch them on tape delay. I vividly remember the Islanders' first Stanley Cup victory over the Flyers. I watched it at 2 o'clock in the morning on ABC, on Channel 5 here locally in Minnesota, because it wasn't on live. This was live ESPN Easter weekend. And I think that also made this game seem as big as any game that we watched on, you know, an NHL side of things back in that era. It was incredible.
Yeah. That was the only game in the league that night too.
It was. All the other series had the night off or had been decided.
Yeah.
And so this was center stage, literally. And a weekend where people are home from college and they're all, you know, gathered around the TV. And it was just such an awesome, awesome hockey game, back and forth. Kelly Rudy played an amazing game. I think he ended up with, 73
saves? He was 73 out of 75 or something. I was 60.
Unbelievable.
60 out of 63 or 62 out of 64 or something or five. He was making saves like crazy.
Well, he had that style too, where he didn't always look good doing it, right? I mean, he was kind of out of position and flopping around, and he battled
moving when the puck was coming.
Yes, it was very unorthodox.
But back then, Gergie, we'd challenge on those angle shots. You know, the rush plays. Yep. You know, it was like going back to watching Jerry Cheevers with the Bruins. You know, he always had the glide lean going, and he, you know, you shoot some on the ice, you're going to beat him because, you know, his feet weren't set.
He's off balance then. Yeah.
Well, that's exactly the way we played. That's the way we played too. We were, you know, we were stand up on our angles, butterfly in the middle. So
it was exactly how I played the game. I was out as far as I could get, and butterfly, you know, I grew up watching you. I watched Donnie Beaupre, you know, those were, you and Donnie Beaupre were two of the best that I could find watching games when it came to that butterfly style. And as you mentioned, we didn't have film. We didn't have internet. We just watched the games and tried to emulate the guys we were watching. And in the mid-80s, I was a college goalie at St. Thomas. And so I was watching you. I was watching Bopes, and I just would try to emulate the way you would move, the way you would come out. Remember, you guys would come out, right? When you knew they were going to shoot the puck, that extra maybe step or half step to get into position was key.
Oh, totally. Angles, cutting angles.
Ugh, you know, that was a Warren Strelo special right there.
Yeah, still today, you know, a lot of coaches say, I don't want to see us stopping pucks in the blue paint. And most guys don't. You know, for all the guys I had, you know, most guys were better when they were at the edge, top of the blue paint, you know. If you're sitting, stopping everything on the back, I mean, we were, I wasn't good that way. And Warren always said, get up, get up, get up. You know, you know, most of the guys always, but it worked, you know, because it
did. I used to go to his goalie schools, and he'd have that bench out on the ice. He'd have that camcorder, and he'd videotape everything. And if you went down, he was on you, like, get back up, get back up, get, I mean, totally different than what we watch now. And again, the equipment's different. The guys are bigger, block and slide this. And it was a different game back then, but he was revolutionary with his angle work and how to manage around the net when you didn't have that big gear, when goaltenders weren't, you know, in our era, goaltenders weren't 6'4", you know, the average height of a goalie was 5'7", 5'8", 5'9" back then. You know, Darren Pang was an NHL goalie and he wasn't 5'5" or 5'6", right? I mean, it was a different time. Yeah. Crazy.
Yeah. It was all those guys were small. Vernon was small. Kelly Rudy was small. Walmsley was small. You know, me and Barrasso were, I mean, Hextall, we were three big ones. Billy Smith was small. You know, they were all under 6 feet. You know, Pelle Lindbergh, Bob Froese, Richter, Van Beesbrook. They're all not even 6 foot. All those guys.
6 foot goalies and above were not the norm. It was the exact opposite.
Yeah. Totally.
Which is crazy to think about now, because if you're under 6 feet now, Alex Stalock's one of the few I can think about that is like, you're the unicorn. You're the one that stands out. It's just, it's flipped completely.
Oh yeah. 6'1", you were a giant back in the '80s. Now you're just a midget, you know, you're just not, it's crazy. It is. It's nuts.
We're going to close the conversation out, Bobby, with the hat trick hot seat. I've got three questions lined up for you. There's no wrong answer. That's the beauty of the hot seat. We just put you on the spot with something that comes to mind top of the head. And I don't know if our listeners know this, but we all do know that goaltenders are the best athletes, and it's no shock that Bob Mason is a scratch golfer. I don't care what his handicap card says. The guy's a scratch. So if you're out there and you want to play for money, he'll have to give you a stroke. So with that in mind, your dream foursome right now, if you can book a foursome this spring and have any three people that are living right now on the planet join you to make up your foursome, what's it going to be?
Wow. That's probably my brother, Billy.
Of course.
Myself. I'd have to maybe go Tiger Woods.
Great pick.
And maybe the old legend. I've shaken, had some pictures with Mr. Nicklaus, but
that'd
I know
be cool.
He doesn't. But back in his prime, yeah. But
even in his 80s, the Golden Bear would be pretty cool to play with. He might not play all 18, but just to have him out there and be able to talk golf with the Golden Bear would be pretty cool.
Yeah. So that'd be good for some.
All right, my next question is, if you've got a night like tonight where let's just say you have got a couple hours to kill at home and you're gonna watch your very favorite sports-related movie, what movie would you watch tonight, Bobby Mason?
Slapshot.
I knew it. Of course. It had to be, right? It had to be.
Oh
God. That movie still, I got to tell you, it still holds up. I mean, it's just awesome.
It is awesome. I've been on those bus rides, Gorgie.
So have I. Yeah. I played in the USHL. I remember those bus rides vividly and some Bruce, of the personalities.
Bruce would fill us in the intimate stories that he had when he was filming on set.
He was so proud. Bruce Boudreau was so proud of the fact that they picked out his apartment. Where Reg Dunlop supposedly lived, and it was just a complete shithole. But Bruce was so proud of that. Anytime the movie came up, he would make sure he'd work that into the conversation. And knowing Bruce, and we both know him quite well, and watching him, it does not surprise me that that was his place, because, man, that place was messy. Holy cow.
Yeah, that's fit him to a T right there.
All right, last question. I'll let you get on with your day. You know, when you live in International Falls, it's probably a long ride to the closest concert venue, but I would love to know your very first concert that you attended.
At the Deck in Duluth.
Oh, boy.
1981, Hall and Oates.
Oh, that's so cool. Oh, that's so cool. My good friend, Paul Allen, PA, a race caller out of Canterbury. That's his very favorite group to go see. And at the Deck, Bobby.
At the Deck.
That venue had to be so cool for a concert. The way those seats kind of overhang, I'm sure, where the stage was, that had to be pretty cool.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was. You know, they were just, that was like 81. They were big back then, but
huge.
Yeah, he hit a ton of hits, that duo. I don't know. We were probably had some beers. I can't remember the whole thing, but I think it was probably in the spring. You know, hockey was over, I think. So it was a night out.
Never have guessed Hall & Oates. I would have guessed a lot of other 80s classic rock bands before I would have got where you went, but that's the beauty of the question. And you never forget your first concert. Mine was at the Met Center. It was Bryan Adams warming up for Journey. I want to say 82, 83.
Wow.
Talk about a great double dip, right? I mean, that's a memorable concert. And to this day, Journey's still my very favorite band. I still, even though Steve Perry is no longer the lead singer, I still go out and see him as much as I can. They're coming again here in the calendar year. I'll be back at the X to see them. But no, you don't forget that first concert experience when you're a kid. That's a big deal.
Yeah, all three of those guys are Rock and Roll Hall of Famers, though, Gorgie. We picked a good twosome there, threesome there.
Yeah. We had good taste. Yeah, yeah, we had good taste in the early 80s, that's for sure. Well, Bob, again, thank you so much for being a part of Wooden Sticks. I love catching up with you. You brought me back to all those conversations, whether it was on the road with the Wild, or I would text you at these weird hours to get some kind of nugget for the broadcast. And I've always loved picking your brain and hearing your insight. And I think most Wild fans can hear it come through here in this conversation today. You don't last 18 years in that position in the National Hockey League and make it through all those coaching changes unless you're really good at your job, which you've always been. And just love catching up today. So thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for the invite. Appreciate it. And keep up the good work. I watch a lot of Wild games. You still got a little... Guys are always giving a little jab once in a while. That's because they like you, Gorgie. They like you.
They're good guys. And I'm very blessed. I enjoy the gig, and it's always the most fun when they get in the playoffs. I know this year it's likely not going to end up that way, but I think brighter days are ahead for this team. And so we'll keep plugging away and hope that they can, in the next couple of years, make a legitimate cup run. And again, Bob Mason, big part of the best run in Wild history back in 2003, the crazy wins over Colorado and Vancouver before running into Jean-Sebastien Jaguar. Ugh, I hate even saying the name, but we'll be back after this quick break. You're listening to Wooden Sticks here on the Talk North Network. All right, we are back on Wooden Sticks as we tie the show up with the final segment here, and really appreciate having Bob Mason join us today. Fun to hear some of those stories and the twinkle in Jacques Lemaire's eye as he used to talk about his team, specifically those goaltending decisions. I remember vividly, I'm not even sure Bob knows this. I probably should have brought this up, but, you know, morning skate, there's always be a presser with each coach. And so Jacques Lemaire would get done putting the boys through the paces, and he'd come into the media room. And the out-of-town media didn't know Jacques like we did, and we knew him well enough not to ask the question because it was clear that he would never tell you the answer, so why ask? And it was always who was in goal. So somebody invariably, after each morning skate, especially when we were in St. Paul, would, you know, ask the question, hey, coach, who's your goalie tonight? And we would all cringe because as local media, we knew that the answer was not going to come, and it probably was going to irritate the head coach. And but Jacques would handle it the same way each and every time. He'd stop, pause, look at the person that asked the question, said, I don't know, but it will be one of the two we have. And he would move on to the next question and be coy about it. And, you know, Bob was a big part of that coaching staff that would make that choice. In fact, Jacques Lemaire would lean on Bob Mason, as he alluded to in our conversation today. So that was fun. Going back to UMD and hearing about not only playing for the Bulldogs, but seeing the great Hall and Oates at that same spot at the deck where he played his college hockey, and loved his time in Chicago. I have great memories as a North Star fan driving down there to watch North Star Blackhawk games back in the day. In Minnesota, we chanted Secord sucks, and in Chicago, they chanted Dino sucks. And I vividly remember those dinosaur blow-up dolls you got at the local Sinclair station. They were all over the Twin Cities. And when you went to a North Star game at the Met Center, you'd see those Dino blow-up dolls everywhere. In Chicago, they'd be there too. And unfortunately, they'd be hanging from a stick with some string tied to it to make it look like a noose. They weren't very nice to Dino at Chicago Stadium. They weren't very nice to me when I wore my Mike Modano jersey down there somewhere around, 1991? The same year he was a rookie, the same year they went on to make a run at the Cup. I had some beer dumped on me at old Chicago Stadium, but great to hear Bob Mason's memories of living there. And just fun to connect with a goaltender. I love talking to former goalies. I'm hoping to have Josh Harding on here later in the next couple of weeks. Josh just completed a great run at Edina with Kurt Giles on that coaching staff. And actually, Josh was a left-handed goalie and had a chance to coach a lefty that led him to state at Edina. I've connected with Jordan Leopold. The Gophers are getting ready for an NCAA run here. We hope that will end in St. Paul at the Frozen Four. Jordan Leopold, about a part of a Gopher team that won a national championship on local soil. So that'll be another guest to keep an eye out for in the coming weeks here on Wooden Sticks. We want you to be a part of the show. I've mentioned her name before. She's outstanding. Her name is Karen Cleary. Email her at K-C-L-E-A-R-Y, kcleary at talknorth.com, and be a part of this show. We'd love to have you as a sponsor. Elevate your business. Bring more people to where you are. We can do that right here. The hockey community is a tight-knit bunch that supports their own. So get involved here on Wooden Sticks. We had a great time today chatting with Bob Mason. You can listen to all our shows. They're downloadable every single day, starting with Lou Nanny. We've gone through some terrific guests. I strongly recommend you listen to the GM of the Minnesota P-Dub team, in Natalie Darwitz. We had Rachel Ramsey on. Just some fantastic guests that you can listen to. Hope you've enjoyed the show today, connecting with Bob Mason. I'm Kevin Gorg. We'll catch you next time right here on Talk North, right here on Wooden Sticks.